Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. Mike here, just introducing this week's episode. We are chatting today to Owen Eastwood. Owen Eastwood is a writer and performance coach originally from New Zealand, now based in the UK, who has worked with organisations like the England football team, the Scotland rugby squad, and the South African cricket teams. And Owen's book, Belonging, The Ancient Code of Togetherness, is all about methods of teamwork and working together as a group and finding purpose as a group to find success based on his own Maori culture and heritage. We recorded this episode a few weeks ago, and I know both Will and Owen really, really enjoyed this conversation they had together. Go and pick up Owen's book, Belonging, The Ancient Code of Togetherness. You can also see Will coming up if you're in the Gold Coast, July 24th at Sound Lounge. You can get tickets on Will's website. You can also support this show, Willosophy, patreon.com/willosophy. For as little as $1 a month, you can help support this show. Keep the lights on here at Tofop Productions and help pay for everyone who works on the show, including James Fosdyke, who does the amazing artwork on this show. As well as that, you can also listen to some of our other podcasts from the Tofop Network, tofop.com, to find out all about those. But we have our main podcast, Tofop, Fofop, a spin-off of Tofop, and of course, Two Guys, One Cup, an AFL-adjacent podcast. Go and check them out. For now, I will leave you with this chat with Will and Owen Eastwood. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and joining me today, this is how the show starts. I ask my guests who they are. So who are you?
Hi, I'm Owen Eastwood. I'm a Kiwi that's been living in the UK for probably far too long. I'm a performance coach, so I tend to work with leaders, lots of different countries, mainly in sport, but also outside sport, just helping them create the best possible environment for their people to thrive in.
So this is so interesting to me. You've written a book, it's called Belonging. It's fantastic, and I'm sure we will talk about the themes of it a lot during this chat. But what is it that brings a person to choose a career where their mission in life is to enable other people's success? I'm very interested in why it is that you thought that was your path.
Well, you know, my honest answer to that is it's been pretty accidental. You know, I grew up in the South Island of New Zealand, very much a farming family, and that's what I thought I'd probably do. But actually got quite interested in academics at school and ended up doing a law degree in Dunedin. And I love that. I was a lawyer for about 20 years. I was a partner in a law firm in London, actually. So I enjoyed all that. But I developed a bit of a network. I'm sure you can relate to this as well. And you get interested in what other people are doing. And my network happened to be in sort of high performance sport. Got to know some of the, you know, coaches around the All Blacks and people in football clubs in England. And you start talking about it. And then I don't know how, but then they sort of invite you into that environment. And then you sort of observe. And then they start having conversations. And I couldn't really help myself to you know, start opening my mouth and sharing some my observations and ideas. And actually, they happened to be quite left field, which probably should have hastened a quick exit. But what I found is that people were bored with corporate speak, the standard management talk, models, theories, philosophies. And I don't know really why, but I was able, because I didn't know anything about any of that, I was able to cut to the chase and just have conversations with them about, you know, how do you find this environment? How do you find leading? What are the challenges you've got? And honestly, that's what it was. It was just people kept engaging and asked me to come back. And ultimately, over a couple of years, really, I got some amazing opportunities, which made me step away from being a lawyer.
Okay. So what I love about this, and it's, you know, sometimes a book comes along. I mean, I was reading this book because I wanted to talk to you on this show, but it just happened to be that I was also in a scenario where I'm putting together a new project and I'm the leader of that project and we're trying to develop what that project is. And so often what I think is at the heart of a successful project is knowing what, you know, question we're trying to answer. What is the story of this show? Forget how we're going to do it, what the segments are going to look like, you know, what camera we're going to look into, any of those sort of things. What is it that we're actually trying to achieve here, and where does it fit into, you know, the timeline of, you know, the people that we're going to feature, the story that we're telling, the connection to the industry that we work in? And then suddenly I opened your book, and even though it was really set in the world of professional sport, you know, high level professional sport, a lot of the things that you're talking about, to me as a program maker, a content creator, a, you know, stand-up comedian, there were so many relevant themes. So why in this interesting story, maybe we should actually, to set the table a little bit more, you could explain to people a little bit about the book and the theme at the heart of the book.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's true that there are a lot of stories and experiences from high performance sport, but, you know, as you know, I also work with corporate leaders. I've worked at the Royal Ballet School in London. I've worked, you know, with the command group of NATO. So there's quite a diversity there. And I really believe strongly, and I've had good feedback on the book so far, is that this is all about human beings who come together to form a group or a team. And it's the dynamics that play out. And it's the thing that energize that group, and it's the things that de-energize that group. You know, that's really the way I think about it. And there's no question in my mind, these same ideas and principles apply equally to families. I mean, ultimately, we're just a group of people thrown together and trying to muddle through and do our best. And there are some things that really enhance that experience and some things that completely stuff it up. So, yeah, I definitely hope the readers see beyond some of the specificity of some of the sports context. There's a couple of things that motivated me. First of all, I didn't really like the fact that in elite environments, people get exposed to some really cool ideas, some great creativity around their environment and the experiences they have together, some amazing wisdom, and actually pretty much, you know, normally, not always, quite enlightened leadership. You know, understanding that your well-being is not just a sort of, you know, a peripheral issue, it's actually fundamental to your performance. If you're not well, you won't have energy and you won't perform. So let's get well-being at the center of everything. You know, we know that your hormonal state has an unbelievable impact on your behaviors. So let's create an environment where you're feeling friggin' good. You know, your anxiety and stress levels are suppressed as far as we possibly can. And actually that feeling of oxytocin, which is making you feel connected to the people around you, and dopamine, which is motivating you, let's get those up. You know, this is what happens in some of these very cool, enlightened and elite environments. But I've never liked that. I've come from a humble background. I don't think that is fair. Why should you have to be sort of have some world-class talent in order to get exposed to a very cool environment? That's BS to me. So big motivator for me was, I think about one of my brothers is a plumber, one of my brothers is a lineman, you know, for an electricity company. Well, why can't they have the same experiences? It's all just about sort of smart environments and smart leadership. So I'm hoping, I love your feedback there, Will, because I'm hoping that people can say, you know what, this isn't just for a privileged few. This is the, you know, there's science behind this and it's great examples. So no, we demand it for ourselves.
I one of the themes that I found, you know, particularly compelling is this idea of, you know, connection, you know, where your story is connected to the overall story. You know, that often they would talk about, you know, you might talk about the, you know, the South African cricket team and having to reckon with, you know, like a changing country and how that team reflected that changing country and how they had to connect with the story that had come before, but also be aware that they were connecting with the part of the story that would come after them. I thought was, where did that come from, and how did you recognize that understanding that we are part of a bigger story is important?
Well, a big principle that, and maybe a philosophy that drives me is just keep things simple. And what actually happens sometimes in you know, these national sports teams is they have overcomplicated things. They're so busy. They've got so much data. They've got so much technology. There's not 5 minutes in the day where, you know, it's not scheduled by somebody to do something. And it's all this noise and busyness and everyone's running around and feeling like, you know, we're doing the right thing and everything's important. And actually they haven't created a space just to step back and what the hell is this all about? And I think the South African cricket team, when I first got involved, were a bit like that. They'd got to the world number one team three times in the previous decade. So they had the world-class talent, but they lost that ranking within a month each time. And, you know, they tried different things to try and arrest that and try and be more consistent, and none of it sort of worked. And ultimately, myself and Jeremy Snape were asked to just look at the culture. The way I would put it is the glue was weak. You know, you and I could probably set ourselves a goal and work together for it, right? And when we reach that goal, if we don't have a higher purpose that sits above it, we'll probably go away and do our separate things. You know, what's holding us together beyond a statistical goal or a KPI? And that's where they were. They had a goal to be world number one, a KPI, but they didn't have any purpose attached to it. So when they got there, everybody sort of got a bit selfish. You know, someone made the analogy that when they were working towards that goal, everyone was putting everything they had onto the table. It was beautiful, sharing, sacrificing, all sorts. But the moment they achieved that goal, because there wasn't any higher purpose that tied them together, everybody started grabbing what they could from the table back for themselves. If I was batting number five, I wanted to bat three. If I was vice captain, I wanted to quite like to be captain. If I had this sponsor, quite like that, more sexy sponsor. And I think that's what happens with a group of people. If they don't have a higher purpose to bind them together, then at some point in time, sometimes following success, sometimes not, selfishness is going to dictate the culture.
It's a theme that I talk about with people all the time, you know, in my industry, which is that no one counts who's getting the most laughs in a funny show. In a funny show, everyone's funny, you know? Like everybody goes, I love that show, you're on that show. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're getting three laughs or you're getting 20 laughs, you know, they love the show. Only when the show is not working do people start caring about they're getting the most of the good lines and getting most of the laughs. It's such a resonant philosophy, like you said, across a myriad of industries. But also working with the South African cricket team gave you an insight into a moment in time and when, you know, a young man's life changed, Australian cricket changed, the way that we look at Australian cricket. And we, you know, in Australia had an incredible mythology around what cricket meant to our country and the way that we played cricket. And then in South Africa, Cameron Bancroft got some sandpaper out of his, you know, pants, and he, like, you know, tampered with the ball, and it became a national tragedy that will be talked about probably well to the end of this century when they talk about iconic moments in Australia. A huge weight, you know, fell on both Steve Smith as a captain, David Warner as perhaps, you know, people saw him as the, you know, the figure behind the scenes, and this young player, Cameron Bancroft, who was just trying to find his place in the team. And I thought your observations around that and the dynamics in what he did on that day and what motivated his behaviour was a really interesting perspective. Can you share a little bit of that with us?
Yeah, I mean, the Cameron Bancroft incident, I would trace back 3 million years. And the reason I say that is because, you know, human beings are a form of primates, obviously. And about 3 million years ago, we left the jungle for whatever reason, probably a climactic change, and we went into the grasslands. And when we're in the jungle, we were actually pretty independent, like most primates are. Like, you can go and forage, there's plenty of food around, you know, you can wander off and grab what you need, and you don't really have to work as a team particularly. Maybe for defense at times you might. But when we went into open grasslands, we didn't have any physiological advantage. That was putting it mildly. We're actually very, very exposed. And what we learned very, very quickly is to survive in that environment, we had to work really, really strongly as a group. We had to look after each other. And then when we wanted something, food or whatever, we had to work together to get it, because one-on-one, we had no chance. And so from, you know, 3 million years ago, our ancestors developed, wasn't just a psychological thing, it's a biological thing, that we need to belong to a group. If we are not in the group, we do not survive. We have zero chance. And now, even in today's world, and everything's changed so much, and we think we're so individualistic, you know, the statistics around early morbidity, around depression, all of these are unbelievably strongly correlated to people feeling isolated and alone. So we still have this need to belong, which is hardwired in us. So when we go into a team, into a group, we have a really high anxiety. Like, am I going to fit in? You know, am I going to be accepted, or am I going to be maybe rejected? So we have this anxiety. So I think clever teams, smart leaders make sure that that need to belong is met very, very early through some very direct messaging. And the Cameron Bancroft incident for me, it was sort of ironic because I was on the other side. I was helping the South Africans prepare for that series. But it was funny, wasn't it? Because so many people said he is a great guy and he's got great character. And, you know, this is a little bit hard to reconcile what happened. And I just picked up on one of his interviews, which was about his very honest reflection that what mattered most to him in that moment was fitting in, was belonging into that team. So therefore, when he was asked to do this thing, you know, that was the first calculation he made, was that if I do it, I'll be more part of this team. But certainly if I said no, whew, that's a huge call to make for a young guy in a new team to say no to your leaders. And you would have faced rejection, no doubt. So that need to belong, even that, kicked in. And I think that was fascinating. But again, it's one of those things people don't pick up on. They just sort of make these judgments. But for me, it's an important part of that story.
The idea that we work because we work together, you know, I love the way that you put it, that like one-on-one, you know, we're not top of the food chain, you know. Like there's no, even the strongest human alive would lose a fight against the laziest lion, you know. It's, you know, we, the collaboration of human beings has been our most successful story. You know, it has been a story not without its, you know, bumps in the road, but it is an incredible story. You know, this perhaps this accident in the corner of the universe, you know, that has evolved into what we have become, you know, because of the fact that we one day decided that we would be stronger together than we were individually. Do you see in modern day society that there is a swing back to the individual? And do you see that a correction of that if you do think that's the way it's going?
Oh, that's beautifully put, Will. I love how you say that. I do, mate. I do strongly believe, and more importantly, scientists and experts believe that our super strength as a species has always been our ability to work powerfully as a group and as a team. That's what's, first of all, enabled our survival, and then it enabled us to work together, to learn together, and then to, you know, be creative together. And it, to me, that's a muscle that we're weakening. You know, we have this unbelievable conceit, really, that we know better than anyone who ever came before us. You know, we've got so much technology and knowledge, and we've got the internet, whatever thing. And we just discount, you know, what our ancestors, but they spent millennia figuring stuff out. And they didn't have the distraction of technology and strategists and all the rest of it. They only had each other in order to feed the village. So for me, there's some amazing wisdom in my Maori culture. I'm part Maori, and the culture, you know, that's been transmitted down has got some unbelievably practical, powerful lessons in what makes teams strong and what makes them weak. So, yeah, I mean, it's true, mate, where we have become very individualistic, particularly in Western societies, the States, the UK, Australia and New Zealand, no doubt about it. We sort of think it's all about us. And I'll give you an example. Yeah, you know, I don't know whether you've been asked this. Maybe it's a question you ask, but people ask me sometimes about my individual purpose. You know, what's your purpose? You know, what are you? That actually doesn't make any sense to me. Just the way I've been brought up and the culture I come from. I don't have any purpose. My purpose is what my family and my teams that I'm in need from me. And for 99.9% of human history, that's how we've thought. It's a very recent invention that we now think that I need to have my personal purpose. I need to have my personal values. I need to have my personal vision. And I don't recognize that. I recognize that my values are inherited from my family and from groups I belong to, and maybe groups that I help create. And my purpose is tied to what's best for people that I'm connected to. And it's a simplistic way maybe, but it's our traditional human way.
So how do we, if, and look, you know, you're preaching to the choir a little here. Like I absolutely subscribe to, you know, what you're saying, the reasons that you're saying and the logic behind what you're saying. Like let's use I want to use an example of something that maybe doesn't fit the mold we're talking about and see what your take is on that. One of the things I loved to do during lockdown was watch The Last Dance, the documentary about the Chicago Bulls and the team dynamic of the Chicago Bulls, the, you know, legendary Michael Jordan era, but, you know, a range of other huge personalities and players. And like, I assume you've like had to think about what that team dynamic was. Why was it so successful? Because in some ways it felt incredibly individualistic. Or is there something else to it that I haven't unlocked? Like, what's your take on the Chicago Bulls?
Oh, mate, I think that that's an example of a wonderful shared purpose and shared identity. And do you know what's beautiful about it? Is that the way you saw it was individuals being themselves. That's what actually an inclusive environment looks like. It's not everybody being clones of each other or just conforming. You know, so just to break that down a little bit further, before the Last Dance, what happened? Michael Jordan was the best player in the world. The Chicago Bulls had failed to be even competitive in playoffs all for the first half of his career. Why was that? Because he was driven on a personal, individual level, but he was disconnected from his team in a large way. You know, they would throw the ball to him and hope for something amazing to happen, and he felt that that was incumbent upon him to do that. So it was a team which was based around individuals, and particularly the alpha, which was Michael, who was the best player in the league. But they failed. They're unsuccessful. The amazing thing that Phil Jackson did, and actually, if you enjoyed The Last Dance, you'd enjoy Sacred Hoops, which was the book he actually wrote after they won the first three, but before they won the second three. And it's just pure, you know? It's not a reflection. It's in the moment when he's talking about how he built that team up. But what he did is he created this collective vision for what they could all achieve together. And coming back to the individualism piece, he had conversations with Jordan where he said, you know, at the moment, you're the top scorer in the league. You're the highest paid guy, MVP. You know, all these things, it's shallow, isn't it? Because he didn't want anything. You know, it's feeding your ego, but there's no legacy to what you're doing. The only legacy will come where people will look at you as a champion and as a great player as if we succeed together. So he built this, not only the culture, which was amazing, was he built an actual system called the triangle offense where it was a democratic way of playing. So everybody had these movements to make, but whoever had that most open shot the ball. It wasn't just giving it to Jordan. And there's two finals games which are legendary. One time John Paxson, another time Steve Kerr took the final shot. And do you know who gave him the ball? Jordan. And because they had a better open shot and they both hit them and won those key playoff games. So he was able to create that shared vision, that shared identity, this beautiful, you know, powerful culture. But he allowed Dennis Rodman to be him, his crazy self, always with one proviso, which is non-negotiable, and that is, you know, the team has to come first. So if you put the team first, Will, you'd be as crazy and as eccentric as you friggin' like. But once you start hurting us, then we're going to have a conversation about whether this is a good fit. So that's good. And people talk about diversity and inclusion all the time. I don't know how many people really do understand what inclusive looks like. It's beautiful, mate, when you can just be yourself, but you're also locked into the idea that, you know, I'm not going to hurt these guys around me.
So how, in a broader societal sense, it feels to me that, you know, when you talk about inclusion in a team sport, it can be broadened out to a, you know, bigger metaphor about, you know, the expectations we have of, you know, certain members of our society, that to, you know, to be considered a true member of our society, you have to adapt to the way that we are living versus that you can be yourself, your true self, and also be accepted as, you know, a member of the community. In Australia, the big theme, and I guess, you know, the way my brain works, and sometimes I apologize for this, is that you'll have talked about three things and they just decide to MasterChef mystery box in my head and, you know, combine together. So this question might feel a little out of left field, but it's based on the fact that you referenced, you know, your connection to your heritage and that incredible story and what it meant to you. It connected to the idea that I think a lot about Australia's, you know, relationship with the First Nations people versus the first, you know, Kiwis and their relationship to what it was meant to be part of New Zealand's story. And it feels to me like they've connected with the entire story now, or at least they're trying much harder to connect with the entire story in the aim that the future part of the story will be, you know, a story where people get to be themselves and understood as just being themselves. And that's, in Australia, we're not there yet. And it's something that really makes me desperately sad about our country, because it feels like we can't see that it's not like, you know, the first people need to somehow, you know, be like us. We need to get to a place where we can accept them for being them and celebrate that, and that be a wonderful, you know, part of our story. Anyway, there should be a decent interviewer would have a really good question at the end of that rather than a rambling observation. But can you understand what I'm saying, and does it speak to a broader thing that we can, you know, sort of take out of the team dressing room into a broader conversation we have about issues in our society, I guess is the question.
I think it does, Will. I think it's a really important point you make. Let's actually just get the political stuff away. Let's just strip it away for a moment and think about this back around our sort of basic humanity and how teaming works. So what happens is, and this is a phenomena in primates, and particularly Homo sapiens, is that when we form groups which are bigger than our family and our kin, what inevitably happens is that there'll be cliques. They are completely natural, because we've always got this desire to belong. And so when the group gets a bit bigger, then we're always going to sort of have an attachment to people a bit more like us, because we feel a bit safer with them, but less anxious. You know, we've got similar traits and we feel like they may have our back. So that's just natural. You see it every single, you know, team, organization, whatever you're going to see. And obviously on a national level, it's much, you know, more visible. So that's a natural dynamic. But what does also happen is over time, the cliques will, either overtly or covertly, they do struggle for power, basically, because we have to work out a way that this is going to operate. And what happens is in small teams, and I've worked in teams where there's been three cliques, it was sort of, you know, four cliques, five cliques, it always happens, but normally one will become dominant. And what that means is that their preferences and their sort of worldview starts to dominate a bit. And everybody sort of has to then operate within that model of the world, you know, that mental model of the world. Now, when you look at it at a national level, same dynamic plays out. And when I write about it in the book, I'm not trying to be political, I'm trying to be sort of objective about what happens, is that what happened in New Zealand is that the Maori people were there first, and then the country was sort of colonized, you know, British settlers came over, but also settlers from a lot of other places. And there was this sort of struggle. It did result in war later, but before the war, there was a struggle, and there was sort of, this treaty was signed with Queen Victoria. But what really happened, if you're just honest about it, is that the clique of the British, and particularly the English, they rose to the top, and their view of the world and their legal and psychological ideas became dominant. They had the power. So they set up courts in a British style, and they set up laws in the British style, and they moved away from communal working, communal living, to, you know, a market economy and all these type of things. So I think once that happens, that's not an inclusive team or nation. That is one dominant clique has really put a template on that everybody has to fit into. And if you don't, you're a criminal. You know, literally you're breaking the laws. So what I love to see in leaders, and I've worked with corporate leaders on that, is that's like a big thing, isn't it? So it freak everyone out. How do you unpack that? But what I'll tell you, some simple things, like in a sports team or in a corporate team, is the leader goes around and asks people some simple questions. How do you find this environment? What do you love about this environment? What do you find difficult about this environment? What about this? Is there anything in this environment that sort of shuts you down? If you were the leader, what would you do differently? Because then people are able to speak from their own worldview and their own cultural point of view. And I'll give you examples. You know, in English football, for example, I've had players from Afro-Caribbean background saying, you know, this is a very Anglo-Saxon way that we're all organized here, and everything is measured. And also there's a real adversity to risk. We don't want to take risk, you know, like, but for me, that's not what I was brought up. Like, we don't measure everything. I've got talent, I've got skill, I just want to friggin' express it. And also when I was brought up in my culture, it was like, go for it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't matter. But I come into this different type of environment, which is set up more of an Anglo-Saxon one. It's like, number one rule, do not make a mistake. So what does that do? So actually there you're getting people who just can't be themselves or express their talent, because the model that the culture is built on is not something that they share.
So that's a really interesting thing when it comes to professional sport, and is in COVID, I'm a huge sports lover, always have been. But there was a period of time in particular, I follow an Australian rules football team called the Western Bulldogs. They used to be Footscray, and they play, they notoriously unsuccessful, had not won a premiership since 1954, had only been in their previous other grand final in 1961. So for my entire life, born in 74, they had never really been successful. Yep. In 2016, they won the premiership. If something happened in my brain, I was so happy for them, but I was released from forgetting that it was a game. I now remember that it's a game. You know, there was probably periods of time as a supporter during that period where I cursed players' names, where I, you know, really wished ill upon these people who were essentially, if we just think about it, playing a game for our amusement. We decided as human beings that part of the way that we wanted to occupy our time was to watch people play games. Guess what? In different countries, we think, you know, you think the Super Bowl is really important. It is, but like in most other countries, they don't even play that game. Like, we think AFL football is really important. Like, it can feel really important on the weekend. It can ruin my whole week that my team played badly. But like, I'm literally getting upset about like a game that people play for our entertainment that really doesn't mean anything other than the importance that we give it. So how, when you work in the world of high level professional sport, like, because it is big business now, that connection, that fight between the fact that you're playing a game and the reason that you came into it in the first place was not that you wanted to measure your skin folds or that you needed to, like, you know, do all these, you know, time trials and tests and all these things. You just loved playing a game with the ball and you ran around and had fun. Like, how do you balance those things in professional sports, people?
That's really interesting the way you articulated that. And I would, you know, respectfully probably disagree a little bit there that it's just a game.
Good. Love it. I love it when people disagree with me on this podcast. It is not the sort of podcast where you get shut down for that. Please tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I'm definitely not saying you're wrong, but the way I look at it is that when you have an affiliation to the Bulldogs, it's not just a game, it's tribal. You know, we have lived in tribes we've been hunter-gatherers for 99% of our history. We are used to having a tribal view of the world. That's hardwired in us, no doubt about it. And in this world, it's quite hard we don't really feel connected to a tribe in many easy ways. Some people do through religion, of course, and the ceremonial and ritualistic way of that is. And you can feel, you know, we're part of this church and you get those feelings. And maybe when you're at school, it's sort of set up for you in that way. But actually, once you grow up a little bit and you're in working, it becomes hard to connect with your tribe. So sports, to me, are a vehicle for people to feel a sense of belonging and a shared identity with something bigger than themselves. And obviously, that's on an even bigger scale when your nation's performing. But same with your Bulldogs. And I actually remember that I'm good friends with Graham Lowe, who was the GM at the time when you guys won that title. So with the South African sports, the cricket team, for example, but others, the way we look at it is that people really care about us. They really care about how we do. And it's not just winning at all. It's that in some ways we are a mirror they look into to see themselves. And I've said it to the guys before, they don't come to see you. They come to see themselves. So when you go and watch the Bulldogs, that's how I think about it, is you're actually wanting to come and see the most beautiful version of yourself. Hardworking, tough, skillful, caring, a great bloke, a good teammate. You want to see all that. And you want to just get a feeling that, you know what? We're pretty special. Like, I'm pretty freaking lucky to be part of this tribe. Makes me feel good and makes me feel proud. And like when I was a little kid, you know, my father passed away when I was 5, and it was, you know, it was quite tough. And I didn't have great self-esteem as a kid, but actually the rugby team that our local rugby team, Southland, unbelievably at that time, we had 6 All Blacks out of 15 players, which has never happened since, that's for sure. So I used to go down there as like an 8, 9, 10-year-old and watch them. And in 1978, we beat Australia, believe it or not. In the following year, we beat France and on these tours. And I'm not joking, mate. I used to come home feeling like I was a world champion. Whilst all the evidence around me in my day-to-day life was that we were unlucky probably, and we had less than other people. I used to feel very, very special because of that team. So I think it comes down to purpose. If a team just thinks it's all about them, then okay, it's a shallow experience. But if a team understands that, you know, like the Australian cricket team, if they understand that our role beyond winning is to inspire and unify our country, then it really shapes everything. And, you know, to be perfect, to be blunt, if we're going to inspire our people, there's certain things we probably wouldn't want to do.
So this comes to a very interesting question then, which is the responsibility of the supporters of the team articulating the standards by which they hold the team. So I think this was what was at the heart of what happened to Australia in South Africa, that we suddenly as a country went, no, hang on. No, we'd prefer you lose than you cheat. But the players, I think, had a bit of, well, that's not really the message you've been giving us. The message you've been giving us is you love that we win and you don't really care how we win. Like, everybody's doing this. We were pushing the rules a bit, but we actually thought what you wanted from us above all else was victory. And now you're telling us that there was actually something more than that. Is there, like, I mean, obviously it's the team's role to understand it, but is there also a responsibility on the supporters of a team, a club, a code to, you know, articulate what they expect from that code and from that team?
Yeah. I mean, I think there needs to be ideally some match, you know, maturity in how we support our teams. And I don't go on social media a huge amount, but obviously that is a problematic area. Certainly over here, English football and other sports, there's a lot of still racist, ridiculous messaging going on, particularly after a team loses. So it's people who are either not very smart or just have very poor emotional regulation. But to more on your point, this is the role of the leader, Will. You know, the role of the leader is not to open all the doors to all the supporters and fans and media and say, okay, listen to them, and that'll shape how we think about what we're doing. The role of the leader is to say, sit down, everybody. This is who we are. This is why we're here. This is what great would look like. And this is how we would need to go about it. So you need to do that work for them. And if it's just tactics and it's just technical stuff and it's just being busy and organized, then you actually miss out on the bigger picture. And that can definitely lead to some of the teams coming off the hinges. I've got no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I mean, it comes to that Steve Jobs idea that it's not the consumer's job to know what their iPhone, you know, should look like. You know, that's their job. You know, they're meant to imagine something that the consumer could never imagine. And I think, yes, it feels like a failure of storytelling from the top up, not from the bottom up. But I'd like to ask you the question because I think it's worth examining what our role in this is as well. Like, social media is a good example, I think. Like, you know, players, again, this is, I think, when it comes back to me of going, I understand the tribalism. I think it's important. I still think it's important. I now just know it's important because I choose to think it's important, and that there are times when I can choose to think it is not important if that would lead to, you know, abusing somebody on the internet, for example. That is like an example of when perhaps you should be choosing to think it's not quite as important. Like, that's just a young man playing a game and you're, I mean, you know, like, again, I'm not, people are all in all different circumstances, and sometimes anger on social media is not about the player who missed the goal. It's about a whole other thing that's happening in that person's life. I feel like you're an empathetic person. Describe yourself. Is that what you're looking for, like a connection with people to understand what it is like to walk a mile in their shoes?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. That's definitely part of my makeup, is that I am empathetic, I think, and probably quite a sensitive person in some ways around, you know, wanting to make sure that people around me are feeling good and having good experience. I mean, just on that previous point you made there, I think something I think would be useful really for fans and the media to understand is that these athletes and elite performers are not superheroes. They're just normal people. And when you actually talk to them and hear how they suffer as a result of abuse, it's really quite sad. And you know, I've known players who have sort of made mistakes in a semi-final of a World Cup and, you know, been abused in airports with their families with them, including their little children, just walking to a gate to catch a plane, and people screaming across, calling them chokers and things. Just absolutely disgusting behavior. And, you know, that may be rare when it happens sort of in real time and, you know, in person, but it's happening on social media all the time. And, you know, these kids, you know, these people have kids and these kids are on social media as well. So, yeah, hopefully we sort of grow up a little bit around this. But I do actually think if more athletes spoke personally. Obviously, we had, you know, the Japanese tennis player last week, you know, who made a stand around this. I think it would be helpful. Yeah, and that's part of my job is when we're talking about culture, it's not just sort of, you know, rah-rah. It's also dealing with people who are suffering at times, either through not performing well, being unwell, or having a hard time from people outside the circle.
So I love that you mentioned Naomi Osaka because I found it sometimes in life, the thing that you realize as you get older, I mean, the thing that I've realized as I got older is that how many things that I have to unlearn that I got ingrained in me when I wasn't paying attention. You know, when you're young and your mind is malleable and you don't know that you're meant to get a second source on things, you know, like you don't understand that not everything your parents or your teachers are telling you might be exactly as it actually is if you do some more work. There are things that get ingrained in you, like that you never knew had become part of your brain wiring, you know? And so my immediate reaction around that was like, well, no, you play tennis, you got to do the... And the minute that my brain said that, I started going, where did that come from? Like, why do you just immediately think that? Because that is not representative of anything else, any other story you would tell yourself about the sort of person you are. You're passionate about appreciating people's mental health spaces. You understand that one size definitely does not fit all. And we're all, but it's not like every tennis player is going to stop doing press conferences. There's plenty of other tennis players. You can talk to all them. And if you don't like talk to her now, there might be a time where she feels good about coming back and talking to you again. Like it's fine. And also she's got 70 million Instagram followers. You know, you'll be able to catch up with what she's up to. She's got a broadcast medium of her own. But all those logical things or compassionate things or whatever they are, all that new narrative of about how I see the world in first blink was not the narrative that popped into my mind. So how much of your job is having to work out what people believe that they don't even know that they believe, the stories they've been telling themselves so often they don't even realize they're telling themselves that story that doesn't connect with the story they want to tell themselves?
Yeah, well, look, that's a good point. It's not actually only just fans and the media that sort of have a sense of entitlement and depersonalize these things. Sometimes it's actually coaches as well. I had a situation a couple of weeks ago where I got contacted by a coach. The team had lost a couple of games and we're just not playing very well. And he just had a chat to me and he just said, look, I'm doing the team talk tomorrow and I feel like we need to shift now because we're on a little bit of a slide here and it's going to, you know, cost us a playoff place if we're not careful. So we need to get back on track. So I said, okay, yep, I get it. So what are you thinking about saying? And he, you know, he outlined his talk, and his talk was like really, really personal and confrontational, saying like, I actually think there's a lack of character in this room. You know, I'm not seeing consistency. I'm not seeing our experienced players leading. I'm not seeing good role modeling here. You know, I think that, you know, we're really probably a bunch of average people playing average sport at the moment. It's like, oh, this type of narrative. So, okay, that's interesting. So he said, what do you think of that? And I said, I got one question for you. You've got a son, right? And he said, yeah. And I said, if your son was one of the players, how would he respond to a talk like that? And he paused and said, he'd hate it and it would demotivate him. I said, okay, let's start again. And so if you think about Osaka as an example, if she was your daughter or your sister or your friend, we would come at it from a completely different angle. And I just think maybe we should do that a little bit more. I also had a situation, a very similar one, where I was one of the Olympic programs over here. I was part of a panel that went in to review their culture. you know, they won gold medals at Olympic Games and all sorts of things. So they're all great. It's all fantastic. But actually had a reputation for being quite a brutal environment. And, you know, they showed us all these things and it was all impressive and all the latest equipment and gyms and coaching and da-da-da. But at the sort of end of these few days there, I asked one of these, you know, key administrators, I just said, who'd given a presentation about how great it all was. And I just said, have you got any children? She said, yeah. And I said, would you be comfortable for your daughter to be part of this program? And like she paused for quite a while. And there were other, you know, quite a lot of people in the room. And she said, no. I said, why? I wouldn't really want her to have this sort of experience. And I've also seen that a lot of people that leave our program are probably less articulate and less confident than their peers who never came close to an Olympic program. So what are we doing? You know? I think we just need to be a bit more compassionate about it. And yeah, I mean, over here, Ollie Robinson has just started playing cricket for England, and some during his first test match, his debut, some racist and sexist tweets came to light. And wow, I mean, even the Prime Minister's jumped in on it. You know, there's a lot of people who are very, very vociferous. And you know, it's definitely issues that need to be worked through. But I think maybe the first thing is, you know, if he was our, you know, son or friend or whatever, how would we approach him, this racist and sexist issues with him, rather than just wanting to hang him out to dry?
So this is obviously one of the huge talking points in our current day society on a broader level, which is the idea of what is an appropriate level of punishment for things that are genuinely against, you know, what we believe is important as a society versus, you know, mob mentality, how long people should be held accountable. And I think probably the bit that we like to get to, or I'd like to get to, which is, do we as a society believe there are some things that you are able to redeem yourself for? And what does that process look like? And can we articulate it a little bit more clearly that, yes, firstly, that's something that he said, you know, however many years ago, it was quite a few years ago. Let's firstly check, does he still believe those things or support those things or stand by those things? What's his current opinion on it? Then what is the appropriate level of punishment for that? It might be something, but let's keep it to whatever the appropriate level is. And then let's articulate what the road to redemption for somebody is in those circumstances and give them some goalposts and let them hit those goalposts. And we kind of, I mean, to me, that feels like we end up better as a society. We give people an opportunity to, you know, address, because we've all, I mean, Owen, I don't understand the amount of mistakes I've made in my life. And I'm somebody that I think in a general sense, people would assume, you know, is reasonably competent. You know, I've had a successful career. I've had, you know, a life that's come with some privilege, you know, like, you know, there are markers of it externally that, you know, look like success and look like somebody who knows what they're doing. But I have no fucking idea what I'm doing. And I make mistakes all the time. And yet we seem to hold other people up to a level of, you know, accountability that I would hate to have trained on myself. And that's not to say that I don't think there's a place for accountability, because I absolutely do. And I think that often it should start with personal accountability. I'd love to hear Owen come out and say, actually, I recognize that those tweets were like, I mean, I wish this had been the narrative, you know, hey, a long time ago, I said some pretty terrible things. I absolutely don't believe any of those things now. And I hope that I've done the work in the last 5 years to be a very different person and watch this space and hold me accountable from now on, because feel free to judge me because I live by a new set of standards. You know, I feel like that's a better world for me, but it doesn't feel like the world that we're living in. The world we're living in is the Prime Minister is commenting on the tweets and everybody in the country is demonizing this person. And it feels like we've lost proportionality on. So anyway, can you speak to the idea of redemption and mistakes and how, I mean, obviously in high level performance, even just in the sporting sense, people have to have the capacity to deal with the mistakes, deal with losses, deal with, you know, moments and have a path back to redemption.
Well, my starting point is, you know, I feel like rejecting people from our tribe is like the last resort, not the first resort. And we're always going to have a diversity of people, and we're going to have some great character people and some people maybe a bit more challenged around that. That's always going to be the way. We're never going to have a group of clones or perfect people. You know, I'll be honest, and I'm definitely not wanting to get anything political here, but when Israel Folau was sort of rejected from rugby union, I love rugby union. I don't agree with his views whatsoever. come from a completely different model of the world. But the idea that he's been rejected from the sport completely, like, still doesn't sit quite right with me. I've always thought of rugby and sport generally as very inclusive. And I wish we had have worked through that somehow, and he was still part of our game and he was still a brother, and I feel sad about that. When it comes to sort of stepping back a little bit further, you know, my job's a performance coach. I'm helping people, leaders, create, you know, the best possible culture for their people to thrive in, you know. So the way I think about it is when issues like this come up, there's often two different ways of dealing with it. One is like the formal disciplinary legal HR process, which I think possibly is happening with him now. He's been suspended and there's an investigation, etc. But there's a different approach. And actually one, I think, like the New Zealand All Blacks rugby team are sort of quite famous for. And that is, when things like this arise, what we do is we get together and we actually try and resolve it ourselves. And we actually don't bring in lawyers and the HR people and all that. We actually just try and work through it all. There was a famous example there where during the 2011 World Cup, just before the semi-final, two of the players went out drinking late at night, a couple of days before the semi-final against Australia. Not only did that, but actually got captured and one of them was smoking. It didn't look great 2 days before the World Cup semi-final. Now, a lot of cultures would, and I, you know, okay, a bit controversial, maybe say more Anglo-Saxon type of, you know, cultures would default to formal process to deal with that. You know, you'd be suspended and there'd be an investigation and maybe you'd be physically removed from the rest of the team while it happens, you know, all these type of things. But that's not how they dealt with it. Well, how they dealt with it is those two players had to go and have a knock on the door of the captain and explain what had happened. And then they had a conversation as well with one of the senior players, really respected senior player, to also explain what had happened. Then they decided that what we need to do is get the whole team together and for you to explain to them what happened. And for you, if you want to express remorse, do that. So they did all this, all behind closed doors, all very quickly. And then the team itself then met together and decided what they thought the appropriate sanction should be. So the management, the leadership, the corporate side of the All Blacks handed all that over to those players to self-regulate. Wow. And I honestly think that you get the best responses that way on balance than going the other way. And I was a former lawyer and I used to do a lot of disciplinary hearings and they were horrible. It was sort of winner or loser, and often the loser felt like a criminal. And it was like, you know, it wasn't a crime committed. It was like, you know, foul play or something silly off the field. So that's how I sort of look at it a little bit. Like I'm wanting to encourage people to try and work through these themselves and not have this massive glare of media and politicians staring at them and trying to tell them how to sort it out.
I'm cognizant of the fact that, you know, we're running out of time and there's some essential questions that I have to ask. So we touched on the idea of a life philosophy before around keep it simple, but I ask people formally if they have like a life philosophy, a philosophy to work, to life, to love, to sport. It can be to anything. Is there anything else you'd love to share?
Well, there's two sort of guiding ideas for me. One is that I do believe that our ancestors had a huge amount of wisdom that we have discounted too much and maybe even neglected. And I think there is a time now, particularly after COVID and the way the world's been shaken up, is that why don't we just take a little bit of time and reconnect with some of the wisdom that's been passed down to us. And from the Maori culture, there's some beautiful ideas, but I've worked all around the world and not only Indigenous cultures, all cultures have some great, powerful ideas that really can help us. So that's the first thing, is that I think, you know, our ancestors' voice, we should just quieten down all our noise and listen to it again. And the second guiding belief for me is, and we touched on it before, was I believe that if we have a mindset where our purpose is what's needed by the people around us, rather than how do I maximize all my opportunity, then we are going to be much stronger. And in families and communities and teams and ultimately in countries. And that's a very much a collectivist view of the world, and it's a very traditional view of the world, and it's a world view that we all had at one point in time. We've sort of drifted away from it. So that's what I would like to see, is that, and it certainly guides me, is that I don't have any personal ambition whatsoever, but I know there's certain things that I can do to help the people I care about.
You talk about the connection from our ancestors, whether they be your ancestors, but all of our ancestors. And again, in the book Belonging, it's very much about one of the key themes is this idea of, you know, connection between the story that came before us, what our place in that story is. And it gives us an eye then on looking to the future, you know, that we don't see ourselves as a culmination of humanity. We see ourselves as part of a story that will go on beyond us and without us, which brings us to one of the questions I ask all the time on this show, which is, what do you think happens when we die?
Well, we live on, mate. We live on because we're part of this unbreakable chain of people that came before us and will come after us. And whether that's your family or whether that's your, you know, religion or whether you're your nation, whatever group we belong to, that this is not all about us. We have a role to play when the sun's shining on us. And to me, that's about inheriting the culture and the values and the purpose and the identity of those who came before and trying to live to that standard and strengthen who we are. And then before our time is done, to pass it on to those who come after us so they can carry on this beautiful culture and this beautiful story that we've been a little part of.
Are you confident, hopeful that we are in the middle of the story rather than in the closing chapters of the story?
Oh, mate, there's a long way to go. I've got no doubt about that. I think our ancestors were smarter than us in many, many ways, and I'm deeply hoping that the people who come after us are smarter than us in many, many ways as well. But, yeah, everybody has their own challenge to face when the sun is shining on us. You know, it's, as I say in the book, you know, there's a Maori idea of whakapapa, which is that we're part of this unbreakable chain of people with our arms interlinked back in time to our origin story and into the future to the end of time. And this is an indigenous idea of other, you know, Native American Indians as well. And the metaphor, the sun just slowly moves down this chain of people and it just reveals us each in turn. And we are immortal, we're unbreakable because our arms are interlinked with the people before and after us. But when the sun is on us, it's never the same as it was on the people before us. It's always unique. It's always completely our own context. And we're having to pick up a bit of stuff, aren't we, mate, to fix. And you know, I think that's one of the questions is that when the sun's shining on us, what needs mending now? And obviously some big things that need mending now, like climate, of course, and the environment. But there's also, I think, what we need to mend now is how we do teaming together and how the environments and the way we lead. I think we need to fix that. Don't think it's great. I think we've lost our way. So maybe that's something that our generation can get a bit better at, and that would help the people who are going to come after us.
Do you have, I mean, I like to ask people sometimes just little selfish questions. And do you have a moment, maybe you don't, maybe you have, I suspect you're the sort of person who has a more diplomatic answer to this, but I would love, is there one particular person you've helped, one particular team you've helped, one environment that you've helped change that you are particularly fond of when you look back on, like one story that you're particularly proud of?
Yep, actually, yeah, there's an answer. Well, as I said, I live in the United Kingdom, but for a couple of years we took the kids back and lived in Auckland in New Zealand. And my son was 9 years old playing for the school basketball team on the North Shore of Auckland. And there's 10 kids in the team. 8 of them were Chinese or Korean and 2 European, well, 1 European kid. And then my son, who's sort of part Maori, part European. And I could, they'd never coach, you know, it's like they'll turn up and play and run around and stuff. So I don't know much about basketball, to put it mildly, but I thought they were so disconnected from each other. And the Asian kids, for some reason, seemed to really lack confidence, even though they had better skill than anyone else. So I decided to sort of get my arms around them. And so I basically treated them in the way that I would treat an elite professional team. We created a space to talk about what we wanted to get out of the season. I got them to introduce themselves to each other. I got them to tell each other what they love about basketball and what their strengths are so we could play to that. We created a bit of a vision of what we wanted to do that season. And I even got a message. This is like 4 years ago. I still got a message from, I did an interview in New Zealand last week, and one of the parents called into the talkback show afterwards to talk about this. But what I loved about that was these Asian boys their confidence just blossomed. And not only that, they ended up becoming great mates with these European boys as well, which previously they would just sort of have nothing to do with each other really in the playground or at school. And I love that experience, and it just really grounded me. And that's, I try and take the same principles into whatever environment I'm in.
If you could have any skill in the world, you don't have to do your 10,000 hours. You just wake up one day and you have the capacity to perform this task or do this thing. What would you just love to be able to do naturally?
Well, I'm 52 now. And I ran, when I was 43, I did a 10K run in 37 and a half minutes. So if I had one wish right now, I'd like to be as fit as that again and run as fast as that, because it's frustrating the hell out of me that I'm getting slower each year. And I know it's, you know, inevitable, but I've actually got this private determination to not lose my speed as fast as I have been.
There might be some things coming up in the future that require you to run away from them. So I think it's probably a handy skill to keep.
Likely, yeah.
Up your sleeve. You would have been in plenty of rooms over the years that have had, you know, slogans plastered on the wall in order to inspire the players. I've really been a person who grew up, you know, with mottos on my wall, but I have a little piece of like hard, you know, metal, and it has engraved on it on my desk. What would you attempt if you knew you could not fail? And for me, it's always just been a good way to remind myself of, you know, just do what it is that you want to do rather than thinking about what is it that people want me to do, you know. But I like to ask people the same question. If you were guaranteed, well, twist it a little, if you were guaranteed of success, what would you love to attempt?
You know, this is authentic, mate, and I know it might sound corny, but you know, every single time I'm working with a team and I feel that connection and we spend time together and they have set a goal for themselves, I get friggin' completely bought into wanting them to be successful. You know, I'm working with England football team, got the Euros coming up. You know, we're by no means ranked number one, but they've got a dream that no England team's ever won that tournament. They'd love to do that. I'm full in on that. You know, I've worked with the British Olympic team, we've got Tokyo coming up, and I know how much it means to those guys. You know, my son's rugby team were unbeaten last season, albeit short, and I was fully bought in, you know, under 14 rugby team. I'm like, I'm fully bought into it. So it comes back to this idea that for myself, I don't have any. I've been spoiled rotten so far with my own personal experiences I've had. But I do, you know, and it doesn't diminish with age. Every time I get in with a team and get to know them, they get to know me, and we get have these experiences, I am all in on wanting to see them achieve whatever their vision they've set themselves.
I was about to finish up, but I've got one supplementary question that I'm just going to squeeze in, and then the final question. So you spoke about the Olympics. It's been something that's been on my mind quite a lot recently. Less so about the event, but just more so about the individuals. So last year when COVID hit in Australia, it hit just at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which for comedians in Australia is, you know, our Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's the time where most people make their money, but they've been working on their shows for a year to present them to the public, you know, in whatever forum during that time. And it was one of the first things that went away, and it went away completely. And yes, people weren't able to pay their rent, or they lost money, these sort of things. But the thing that I really thought about a lot was that somebody had dedicated a year of their life to wanting to do something, and then that thing was taken away. The Olympics, these people have often dedicated, you know, well, 4 years, probably minimum, 5 years in the last cycle, but, you know, a lifetime before that as well, to compete in something, to achieve something, to work towards something. But obviously there's still got to be a huge question mark hanging over the idea that the Olympics will happen, or it'll happen in the fashion that we imagine it would happen. How do you work with athletes when they are working towards this one moment, the Olympics, you know, in some ways above all of them, because the time you have to work on that one moment that you have to seize is, you know, pretty much disproportionate to, you know, any other sport in the world. And the idea that it just might not happen. How do you, work with people when they're under that circumstance?
I think there's one distinguishing feature of high performers than the general population that I've noticed, and that is optimism. I've spoken to, sort of experts in this area who say that human beings are actually hardwired to be pessimists, because, for most of our history, you need to be very careful of what was around you. You better be cautious. Things could go wrong and you protect yourself. If you're a blinding sort of, optimist about everything, you probably wouldn't survive very long. So it's sort of hard.
Well, that's right. Yeah. It's not the optimist's fault. It's the pessimists were the ones who actually were right. And so they survived and they got to breed. And so, we're predominantly pessimists. Yeah.
That's exactly right, mate. Actually, it's interesting. With high performers, there's a complete disproportionate makeup of optimists. And optimism is, the simple idea that I actually think something good's about to happen, as opposed to I think something not good's going to happen and I need to bail out, or I need to have a protection strategy with it. So, and it sort of makes sense. There's so much adversity and challenges and filtering that goes through in order to be a top athlete. It makes sense to me. So, we've had some great conversations with some of the top athletes in the British Olympic team going up. And I actually have been amazed in many ways about how positive and optimistic they are. And they know it's going to be different, of course. They understand that. But in terms of the experience and their own performance, I've not yet had a conversation with anyone who said, I'm going to fail. This is going to be terrible. I'm not going to enjoy it. I haven't prepared well. I was expecting at least some people to maybe talk along those lines, but I haven't heard it at all. I've heard people saying this will be different. It'll be friggin' special. And I've done the best preparation I can. And you know what? I reckon I'm competitive. So yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about those guys. I'm not feeling sorry for them. I actually just think they're going to reframe it in a very different way. And think they'll be fine.
Thank you so much for this. I've really enjoyed it. I love the book. I really highly recommend it to people. Like, if you're interested in sports, if you're interested in high performance, if you're somebody who's looking for, maybe you're just looking for a connection to your story and your life and being able to recognize, who your tribes are and how they interconnect, I think there's a lot of really valuable stuff. Thank you so much for becoming part of, this Willosophy tribe, a little bit of the glue in our story. I appreciate that, this is part of it and it's been really fun to chat to you. I always finish with this question, which is, I have a time machine. I can travel to anywhere in the future, anywhere in the past. It is a round trip. You have to come back. You can't stay. You can go and affect something if you want to affect something, or you can go and observe something if you want to observe something. I have no rules or regulations other than the return of the machine at the end of the round trip. Where would you like to go?
Oh, what a cool question. Where would I want to go? I'd like to go to a island called Raratea, which is in the Central Pacific Ocean, which is now in French Polynesia. It's an island 64 square miles. It's very, very small. 1,000 years ago, my Polynesian ancestors embarked on the most epic voyaging ever in human history from that island. They went all the way to the east to South America. They found artifacts in California and arguably in Alaska, apparently. They went north and discovered Hawaii. And this is all just in a few generations. And they went south all the way down and found Aotearoa in New Zealand. But what was amazing is that they came all the way back to that island after they'd made these discoveries to share it. And then, the migrations happened. And this is a people who had no written language, had no instruments and no maps. It was all based on star navigation and their understanding of the sea, their observation of the migratory patterns of whales and birds and turtles and things. It was unbelievable. And there are books now written saying, without a doubt, they from that island, they discovered 25% of the Earth's surface. And I think there's nothing better than would have been part of that amazing moment in history.
Thank you very much for joining the show, mate. I've had a ball.
Oh, it's been great. Well, really appreciate you, and I love your work, mate.